This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Growing up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Jeanette Stokes never dreamed of becoming a minister. In fact, as a young person, she'd never seen a woman of the cloth. But her faith grew, and so did her political consciousness. Jeanette started to connect her interest in feminism with her understanding of the Christian church. She has since dedicated her life to supporting women's spirituality both in and out of the church. Jeanette Stokes is the founder and executive director of the Resource Center for Women and Ministry in the South, and she joins us today. Jeanette, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Tell us about the center itself, the Resource Center. It is a resource center for women and ministry in the South.
Frank, the first thing I should say is never give an organization a name that long.
It's
no
long
one
name.
Can remember it. Call it something short like ACT. The Resource Center began in 1977 when a group of us graduated from Duke Divinity School and looked around and noticed that there was not yet a lot of support in Protestant denominations for women going into ministry. So three of us formed a nonprofit here in Durham, which moved fairly quickly to Greensboro because I moved down the road. And the stated purpose was to be support for and to connect women who were in and entering ministry. And we meant that in the broadest possible way, people in ordained ministry and also all of our Catholic friends who were women religious couldn't be ordained, and we included them. And just as soon as there were women rabbis in the state, we included them as well.
What are the challenges? Are there particular challenges for women who are ministers?
Well, there are challenges today, and there were even more in 1977 when we began. Let me go back a step, if that's all right. While I was in seminary at Duke, I served as the coordinator of the Women's Center at the Divinity School. It was brand new. And one of my jobs was to go out in the summer and visit women in placements in mostly rural churches around North Carolina. And I noticed early on that they were having a difficult time in their various locales because they were being treated like they were children or very young.
Was it, let me ask you,
yes,
if it was indeed unusual at that time, we're talking mid-70s, I guess, for
right,
women to be ministers, to have their own congregation.
Right. It was still very unusual. In the United Methodist Church, which I was not a part of, but which Duke is affiliated with, because they have a placement system where the bishops and the bishop's cabinet places people in local churches, the local churches didn't always have a choice about whether they received women ministers or not. Some of them did so willingly. Some of them learned to love the women. Most of them learned to love the women who served them because they were good at what they did.
So what does this mean, treating them like children? How did that express itself?
Well, they would get inappropriate sexual comments. They would be asked to work only with the children or the young people. They wouldn't, if they were interns, they wouldn't be asked to preach very much. Once they were ordained ministers, they would be relegated to patted on the head or told how cute they looked or things that demean professional women.
And I guess, I mean, ministers having mostly been men up until then, many times married, the minister's wife had a role to play, and now this woman comes in. It might have been hard for that congregation to sort that out, huh?
Certainly. And we said at the time in the 70s and 80s that congregations didn't really know what to do with women. If they were single, they sometimes thought they were supposed to try to find them a date with a guy. If they were married, they didn't know what to do with the male spouse. He wasn't going to lead the women's auxiliary. And he may or may not have been able to play the piano. And so roles developed for clergy husbands over time.
Now, also at this time, ideas about feminism are developing and emerging, and you're paying attention to that. I mean, that's somewhat different than the slightly cultural distance or dissonance that you might feel having a woman lead a congregation. Was that an element in this, that women in general, that the roles of women were changing, and this is part of the preaching?
Yes, certainly. I graduated from college in 1973. from Smith, and just by happenstance, I rode the crest of a wave of women going into graduate and professional schools in larger numbers than ever before. So women were going to law school and medical school and getting PhDs and also going to seminary. So there were, when I arrived at Duke Divinity School in 74, there were larger numbers of women enrolled.
How did you go from, when did you get the idea at a place like Smith that where you wanted to go next was Divinity School?
I didn't get that idea exactly. I graduated with a degree in mathematics, which I will tell you as an aside that I studied because I liked it and also because I don't spell perfectly. And all of my papers in my humanities classes had red ink splattered all over them. So I was active in the chapel at Smith, where I learned about progressive Christianity. I had grown up in a moderate Presbyterian church in Oklahoma. And I saw the college chaplain participating in social actions and protests, like getting arrested, protesting nuclear warheads or the war in Vietnam. And so I left college with an interest in religion, which I'd had all my growing up life, and came to Durham and worked substitute teaching, and I worked for a lawyer, and I worked at the YWCA. And after a year, I decided that school was more entertaining, and so looked around. And at that point, I thought, okay, graduate school in mathematics, law school, which I thought was the way that people changed the world, or divinity school. And so I applied to all of them, and it came down to staying here because I liked Durham and going to divinity school at Duke.
What was it like for a woman to go to divinity school then?
It wasn't a bad experience. I hit there at a good moment with there were over 30 women in my class and some women in the classes, two classes above us. And the women who were there, no one had ever said, like when they were six, you should be a minister, because that wasn't really going on in America. So they'd all had the idea somehow for themselves. So they were a very bright, very smart group of women. So that was fun. There was only one woman on the faculty at the time, a woman named Jill Raitt. But many of the men at Duke Divinity School who were professors had come through the civil rights movement and had a kind of openness to what we might call social gospel or social change, or people saying, excuse me, sir, white man, but there might be another way to look at something. So they'd had some of that opening of heart. So when we approached the faculty with questions about women, some of them were bewildered, but were open. So I went through many of my classes at the Divinity School raising my hand and saying, excuse me, but what about the women?
So, and that's the other project, it seems to me, about awakening religion, particularly Christianity. And as you say, there was this division at the time, particularly 60s and 70s. Are we about a kind of social ministry that would enact some of those teachings that we heard and that had been written down 2,000 years ago? Or is this some spiritual project that has nothing to do with all of these social causes? And you're right in the middle of that. And I assume thinking, no, we have to be on the ground making social change.
Right. Doing both. And even while in seminary, we were trying to organize workshops that would support women who were being developed in a profession that was new to us, the ministry. At the same time, we were having worship services in Duke Chapel, the big chapel on the campus, where we would go up and sit on the floor where the choir sits and have inclusive language worship services where we used images that were about God as male or female or spirit. And so we were working then, and I've continued working these decades since, on both changing the culture and changing spiritual practice so that they accept and support women in new ways.
This just occurred to me, and I'm going to have to now wade waist deep into a thicket of mud and stereotype. But I'm now imagining the men who are drawn to the ministry, particularly who go straight through, who don't come at it from some other route after having been a sea captain and a lout for a while. If they go right through school, I would guess those are some of the most compliant men in school. I mean, they're devout, they're pious, and they want to become ministers.
At least compassionate.
Certainly compassionate, but always, but and with a certain amount of piety. women in the 60s and 70s who want to break, who want to do this transgression, might be some of the least compliant people in divinity school.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. There were some marriages while we were in divinity school, and some of them have worked out very well, and some of them did not work out so well because of what you have just outlined. At one point, I actually went to a pastoral counselor at Duke and to ask questions about the gender role differences that you've just described. I noticed that the women were very assertive and were taking on roles that men had had in the culture, and that the men I was in school with were wonderful human beings, but they were of a gentler sort. And so the gender roles were a little bit flipped from the culture in which I had grown up.
We will talk more about that journey and where it led when my conversation with Jeanette Stokes continues. She's founder and executive director of the Resource Center for Women and Ministry in the South. We'll find out more on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Jeanette Stokes, founder and executive director of the Resource Center for Women and Ministry in the South. So we've heard a little bit about your college days, getting to Duke Divinity, but actually I want to take you back to your earliest days in Tulsa, growing up in a Presbyterian church. What was it like growing up for you, and how churched up were you back then?
I was very active in my local church. My mother had grown up Presbyterian, and she and her mother sort of had a hold of me in a way that I didn't realize until later. And I grew up in a neighborhood church, which was actually a very pleasant experience in the 50s and early 60s. The church seemed to attract ministers who were interested in the world, interested in psychology. I remember we had a choir director who was Italian, Carmen Graziano, and he made singing in the choir a lot of fun, even though I wasn't a tremendously good singer. Tulsa was the oil capital of the world at that point. Our local fairground had an enormous gold oil man in the middle of it. It was before the oil companies moved to Houston. And so my church, like my school, was full of my neighbors, and it was not a very integrated community. As a child, I was sort of unconscious about a lot of the social issues, so it was, for me, pleasant.
Right. So social justice, in that sense of the term, was not central to the ministry back then, would you say?
No.
When did that – but you had a sense of growing up in the church and liking it. And you stayed in the church? Did you ever sort of kick and scream and run away?
A little in college. But what I liked about the church is that nobody ever ran me off for asking questions. Mm. So my Sunday school teachers would give out of answers. The ministers would talk to me as long as they had attention. But they didn't give me the impression that I was not to ask questions. I can remember being in confirmation class, 11 or 12, and the minister saying to us, "Now, you can write your own prayers. It's fine to use your own words to speak to God." And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. So
Did you experiment with a prayer that they didn't like?
No.
That's good.
Yeah.
I did
experiment, and they didn't say they didn't like it.
You were going through, you said the experience was mostly pleasant, but your parents divorced when you were young.
Yes. Yes.
About 12 or so?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. My father left the family. We were three. I was an only child, my mother, my father, and I. We were all Geminis, which meant there was a lot of chaos in our relationships. But my father left the family and created another family of his own. A couple of years later, after my mother healed from the shock of that, she also married again. And I was then part of a family of four. My stepfather had a daughter who was younger than I.
Was this when you started going back and forth between Tulsa and Texas?
I had done that all along. My mother was from a tiny little town in Texas called Grandview that's about 45 miles south of Fort Worth. Her ancestors had actually come from North Carolina and, like a lot of people, had moved west in search of land and trying to prosper. And so from the time I was born, she and my dad took me regularly to visit in Texas, summers and Christmas every year. I never saw the blue bonnets bloom because we never went at Easter. And I would spend several weeks there in the summertime.
How was the church there? I assume you were going
to church. Well, the Presbyterian church at that point was divided into two different churches, many churches and many denominations in this country, but two main ones that I'll just call the Northern Church and the Southern Church. And my grandmother's church was a tiny little rural church in the next town over, Itasca. And the minister there reminded me of Ichabod Crane, the minister in the Sleepy Hollow story.
Yeah.
And I found him tall and thin and frightening, and I didn't recognize the Sunday school curriculum, and the hymns were a little bit different. My grandmother led the choir. And so I thought of the Texas church as kind of the Dark Ages, and my Northern Presbyterian church, United Presbyterian Church in Tulsa, as the modern era.
Well, that's interesting in and of itself, in that you get to think about the fact that a church united under one name can have many variants when it comes to the practice of that
exactly.
faith. So, and what then, how did you end up going to Smith? What made you want to go there? You studied math, obviously. Were you interested all that time?
Right. Yes. I was in the group of smart kids in my high school, and we all did kind of advanced English classes and advanced math classes. And it was a public school in Tulsa, and we were not known for good quality education, but we had excellent math and English teachers. So I was fortunate. And I, when it was time to apply to college, my best friend Sally, who was a year older than I, had a mother who had gone to Smith. And I was in their house a lot, and her mother was kept talking to me about this college. And I didn't really want to go to a women's college. I didn't really want to go to New England, and I didn't really want to go where it was cold. Well, I applied a bunch of places. That was one that I was accepted to, and on a probably unusually sunny day in Massachusetts in April in 1969, we went to visit, and I fell in love with the place.
That's how they do it down here in reverse, you know,
right.
Carolina and Duke. They just bring all those guys from Harvard down here in January.
Right, and they fall in love
good
with
trick.
It.
Good trick. It's a good trick. What made you – because you said you were in Durham when you applied to law school and divinity school. And the fact that divinity school, you know, that you could stay here was part of the reason that you chose that. What brought you here in the first place?
I found New England cold. The weather was cold and the people were brusque. And so I knew I didn't want to stay there, although I enjoyed 3 years at Smith and 1 year at Amherst College. And I had a really good friend who was going to live in Durham because she had a sister here, and I had a boyfriend from Amherst who was going to go to Chapel Hill to law school. And it came as a surprise that when college was over, I had to move out of my dorm room and go somewhere. And so I went to Tulsa for a while and visited my family. I had a summer job in New England, and then I moved here.
What was Durham like at that time?
Durham was a scruffy place.
Yeah.
We're
talking now early
73, and I lived in an apartment on North Duke Street, and if the wind blew the right way, when we opened the door in the morning, you could smell the tobacco on the air. And it was a scrappy place. There were progressives already. The sort of white West Durham progressive community was already forming because there were Duke students older than I who had graduated and stayed here. But I remember driving around Durham, particularly on Hillsborough Road near where the Harris Teeter is going in now.
Mm-hmm.
There were just closed up parking lots that had been part of, I guess, an old mill that had been there a long time before. And so there was barbed wire, and I would drive along and think, why did I move to a place that wasn't very pretty. I had intended to live in Chapel Hill, which is, of course, cute as a button.
But it is.
Is now and was then.
Yeah. Well, so you did decide to stay here, and you ended up getting a job with the YWCA.
Right, which no longer exists. It's downtown where the police station is between Duke and Gregson on Chapel Hill.
Oh, yeah.
There's a parking lot there now, and there was a big stately brick building that was the old YW.
What kind of work were you doing? Because the YWs were very progressive. Sadly, the one in Raleigh had been active for a long time.
Yes.
And then that just closed. They were very active and progressive organizations.
Yes, they were, at the national leadership and locally. I had a really ordinary job, important one. I was in an after-school program, and I played with kids after school from the end of the school day till their parents got off from work. I had had a long history in summer camps and had worked in other after school programs, so I had a job.
Are you hatching at this time this notion of creating a resource center for women spirituality, particularly
Not yet.
Those in the ministry?
Not yet. I had while I was at Smith, the first women's center in the area and one of the first in the country opened at the University of Massachusetts, which was just down the road. And so I knew about this notion of women's centers, and the YW in Durham, that's 73-74, had a social work intern named Gilda Nance who was working on women's issues. I think that they had given her that job assignment. And so there would be posters around about women's groups and speakers and I think she helped to arrange for there to be some women's dances in the basement. And so the Y became a sort of hub for women's culture and organizing and feminist culture and organizing in Durham.
So you're doing that. You go to divinity school. You become an ordained minister.
Which was not the plan at the beginning, but I graduated with a credential and there was clearly a need. So,
had you ever had a congregation? Have you had a congregation?
No. I've done all the things that congregational ministers do, married and buried and baptized people, but the Resource Center has been my ministry.
I want to talk more about the center, of course, but what about that ministry, having the congregation? Do you ever think that that's something you want to do, or is this is it?
I always said when I got to be older and taller, I'm only 5'1", that I would want to serve a congregation. I've done plenty of preaching, but it turns out that the group of people that I have nurtured in the way that a pastor nurtures a congregation are people who've been associated with the Resource Center. So I have exercised those gifts and graces with the people who found our program.
Tell us about the program. What goes on there? What goes on there, Jeanette?
What does go on in that little grocery store building on Watts Street in Durham? We have offered resources and programs and support over the years. And the resources are in the form of a newsletter that both carries articles and lists events that we sponsor and things that we think will be interesting to our constituents that other people sponsor. We've also published books and have a website and have published DVDs and music CDs. So we provide resources. Those can all be found at www.rcwms.org. If people want to look for them. We provide lots of programs, both short-term, like last Saturday we had a writing workshop for 3 hours. We have a lot of programs on writing these days because somebody gave us a grant 10 years ago and got us started down that path. We have week-long writing workshops for women at the beach 3 times a year. We have programs on spirituality, on meditation, on creativity, and on social justice. And then we do a lot of all of us on the staff do mentoring with younger people or older people who are finding their way through the riverbed of life.
Are there particular programs still for women who are ministers, and is there still a need for that kind of thing?
There is still a need. The Protestant denominations, the mainline denominations, provide many of those programs themselves. So after I graduated from Divinity School, for instance, in 1977, it just took about 6-8 years for there to be enough women ministers in various areas around the country and even the Southeast for them to begin doing their own programming.
You created also as part of this a labyrinth, and I understand that you actually designed that initially.
Yes.
Tell us about the importance of that. Yeah.
In the late 1990s, I went to California several times and saw one at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. And because I had one degree in mathematics and one in theology, I thought, well, I can make one of these. I should have had a degree in architecture or engineering. And so I went and visited several times and found out how to make one and ordered 125 pounds of unfinished canvas, just like you would get to paint a picture on, and drew concentric circles and made this circulinear path, which is a long curving path inside of a square that's about 40 by 40 feet. The practice is that people walk slowly and in a meditative way on this path, which takes them 10 or 15 minutes, arriving at the center of the labyrinth, which is in the shape of a rose, which is actually an ancient icon for the Virgin Mary. They sit and meditate and then walk out again. We have it at Duke Chapel once a year, and we had it at Binkley Baptist Church during Holy Week this year, and a couple of hundred people usually come and walk on it.
Interesting icon. I mean, the idea of the Virgin Mary at the center of this, which is, you know, controversial doctrinally among Christians, and it's sort of in feminist circles, this idea,
right.
And yet at other levels, sublime. Is that something that you chose to keep? Obviously, you didn't have to have that. I don't know if it's incidental to all of it or if it much matters. Maybe it didn't. It's just there and you just sort of keep it.
That's a really interesting question. The pattern that we use that we have on our labyrinth is taken from the cathedral at Chartres in France. That's about an hour from Paris. And originally, there was a plaque of Theseus and the Minotaur on bronze.
We can all agree on that one.
That's right. Which Christians in the Middle Ages, 1200s, when they put this thing in, would have agreed that was a struggle between good and evil. But it's located in a cathedral that was dedicated to Mary. It was a Notre Dame cathedral. And so the rose that is in the middle of the labyrinth and the rose that is in the middle of the famous rose window at that cathedral both represent her. I like that it's just a pattern of a flower. So if you are not a Christian, it can mean whatever you want. And if you aren't a Catholic, it probably doesn't even remind you of Mary. What I like best about it is that there's nothing smack in the middle of it. When we were painting it, I was so excited. We were about to get to the middle, and it had very few lines on it because it's mostly empty, allowing people to bring whatever they need or to receive whatever they need there.
That idea, the fact that your programs include a lot of creative writing, space for meditation and growth, runs counter at least the knock. The knock against religion is that it is doctrinal, that it is prescriptive, that people have to sort of interpret things in only one way. It leads them to a very narrow set of conclusions and perhaps very narrow minds. You see spirituality and religion as something far different, and creativity is at the center of it.
Yes. I was raised as a Presbyterian, and as best I could tell, I was being taught to think about God correctly and to speak to God correctly. So it was, in fact, doctrinal. But Presbyterians and Protestants in general are credited with education. That was part of what was going on during the Reformation, is that the Reformers wanted for people to read the Scriptures and think for themselves. So while I was taught to do things correctly, I was also taught to think. Spiritual practices were pretty much confined to going to church on Sunday morning, saying my prayers before bed when I was a child, and saying grace at the table. And I'm sure that the ministers and my parents told me that God was everywhere in the world, but I had sort of put God in those places. So with a growing movement over the last decades to let God out of those boxes and out into the world, and also with Protestants picking up some of the spiritual practices that Catholics, monastics, and contemplatives have had for thousands of years, I now see spiritual practices as a much broader thing.
Much, much broader, and it's often compared with religious practice. You often hear this distinction between spirituality and religion.
Right.
And spirituality tends to be that very large, universal, all-encompassing. So
right.
Then the question is it different? Is the practice of spirituality different for women? Does there need to be a women's center when it comes to a spirituality?
Well, if we begin with the spiritual practice that seems to be most accepted across faiths, which is silence, then it pr- it might not be so important, but if we are going to add words and descriptions of our lives and conversations about what it is to live as a faithful person, then there are places for people with whatever differences. I might start one for short adults, for instance. Mm-hmm. But there is a place, I mean, there certainly was a place in the 70s, and there's a place today for women to talk about the particular struggles in their own lives and the way that they understand God at work and the way that they meditate and pray.
We will talk more about that when we return. My guest, founder and executive director of the Research a Resource Center for Women and Ministry in the South, Jeanette Stokes. And the conversation continues after this. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Jeanette Stokes, founder and executive director of the Resource Center for Women and Ministry in the South. We're talking about the particulars and spirituality writ large is about the biggest, most universal things, but we live in a political world where we are distinct, whether we want to be or not. You were working at the YWCA in the 70s at a time when feminism was coming of age, and certainly the YWCA here played a part in that. What was going on in terms of feminism and this southern city of Durham, North Carolina? What did it look like here?
Well, Durham became a mecca for progressives and for feminists and for lesbian and gay people. We didn't have the BT on the GLBT thing then. The women's community was growing in Durham. And dances were a part of that. There were consciousness-raising groups. Feminists like Sarah Evans and had been students at Duke and had started a business in Raleigh called Lollipop, which was feminist books for little children. So just these things began to grow. And then one thing that happened is that Lady Slipper Music, which is a women's music promotion and distribution company, started here in the late 70s. And then a women's cotton underwear company called Travis Place started here a little after that. And so the community that had begun gathering at the Y grew with its own businesses and cultural activities over time. Meanwhile, I went to seminary, formed the Resource Center, and actually lived 50 miles down the road in Greensboro, but would come back to Durham. We offered some events over here. People would come to Durham. And so the women's political, cultural, and spiritual communities kind of grew together.
What brought you back to Durham from Greensboro?
I wonder if there's anybody from Greensboro listening. I loved Greensboro. It was a wonderful place to live, but the cultural richness, the universities and the three towns in the triangle are pretty hard to beat.
They're getting there now. Greensboro, things are really moving.
It's a wonderful place.
Yeah, and it's moving kind of full speed ahead. But this, we're talking about the 70s now.
Yep.
And
I came back in 88, right, so we'll go back.
We're talking too about consciousness raising feminism. Right. We had a conversation a couple of weeks ago on this program that one of our guests suggested in some ways, you know, we talk about this being a post-racial age because we have a black president. Feminism too, when women's shelters, for instance, violence against women created shelters with a very strong feminist political component. Now that it's been normalized, now that the state and other nonprofits are taking over, some of the politics has gone out. Do you think leading us to believe that the problem is over and that, you know, because the politics has gone out of the organizing, are we victims of our own success in some ways?
I wish we were. The research doesn't bear out that we are over needing to heal racial divides, or that we have figured out how to incorporate all of women's gifts and graces into the culture. Women still do the overwhelming amount of parenting in families. Victims of violence, of domestic violence, the numbers of deaths of women have not gone down in these many decades that we have been working on that issue. what the shelters have really helped with is the number of deaths of perpetrators that have gone down. So to be able to get women out of bad situations provides them with another alternative than doing violence themselves. And Rachel Seidman was on your program not too long ago, and she and her students in a course at Duke University about a year ago started a website called Why We Need Feminism. Do we still need feminism?
Yeah, yeah.
Which you can find on the web. And so young women are on this website holding up signs explaining why they need feminism, that we're not through. We have not made it an equitable society yet, even though women and people of racial ethnic heritages have been speaking their concerns for multiple decades.
So it's interesting. We still need to remain awake, conscious, politically active, political beings, and not just consumers in terms of our social interactions. And then as we get back to these spiritual questions, what is it that women – what are the obstacles to becoming a fully spiritualized human being, acting in normal ways, having to wash dishes and pick up the dry cleaning and all that? When women express to you the challenges of accessing their deepest inner selves, what are some of the challenges here? And how much of that has to do with just modern life?
Well, several things occur to me. One is that everything we do every day is in fact sacred. And that what gets in the way of being a faithful religious person or a conscious spiritual person is forgetting that. And so most of our practices, whether they are going to be with our congregations on Friday night or Saturday or Sunday, whenever your congregations meet, the practice of going reminds us. The practice of meditating every day or praying or doing yoga or walking in the woods help us to remember the presence of God in daily life. I agree that modern life is driving us over some sort of a cliff. I went for a walk a few weeks ago and had to say to myself, leave the phone at home. You do not have to be plugged in every single minute.
You are now part – writing workshops are part of the Resource Center, and you're a writer yourself and working on another book.
I am. I've published two collections of essays and a book called Hurricane Season about surviving a divorce. I'm this summer will publish a book called Flying Over Home, which is a memoir, but focused on my relationship with my dad.
Tell us about that. You discovered a set of letters that had quite an impact on you.
Yes. I have cousins in Georgia who are older than I am, children of my father's brother, who, after their father died, sent me a collection of letters that my father had written to his brother, a Baptist minister in Georgia, while my father was in medical training. So here in my mailbox arrived my father as a young man in his 20s. This was in the 1940s, during part of this time the Second World War was going on. And I met my dad as a young man whom I would never have had any way of knowing.
Who was he? Who did you discover in those letters?
Oh, he was so full of life. He was smart, and he was friendly, and he was warm, and he went to medical school. And he actually went to Duke first. That's where he spent his first 2 years. He was on the swimming team as a diver. I have to tell you this. They called the swim team, when he was at Duke, the Duke Mermen. Mm. Can you imagine swimmers putting up with that today? Anyway, he went to medical school and did a internship in New Orleans and a residency in Dallas, and he was so full of life and feisty. He won a little money at the racetrack, and he bought a sailboat to go out and have fun. And his letters are full of his wanting to make a life. They include his meeting my mother and deciding immediately he was going to marry her. She didn't agree to that at first. And so the fun thing for me is that I see some of my own energy and love of life in him.
You are speaking glowingly of him now. That's not how you felt about him after the divorce and for much of your life before.
Oh, no. When he left, I took my mother's side. I decided that he and everything connected with him was bad. And I did continue to see him. He left when I was 12, but he died when I was 24. He was an alcoholic, and his alcoholism increased. So my ability to have a real relationship with him declined. And I think my parents' divorce was probably the organizing principle for my psychological life. And over the years, finding a way back to being able to really appreciate him and love him has been part of my spiritual journey.
Were you doing that and on the path before you got these letters?
I think so. Some really great therapists along the way had been helping. Somebody, even when I was at the Divinity School, suggested that I was there because I was mad at my dad and I was out to get the big dad in the sky, meaning God. Mm-hmm. But actually writing off and on for 10 years on this project gave me a container for all of that. And it also sent me looking for more information about him. He was from Savannah, Georgia. I had not spent a lot of time there as a child. His mother died when I was about 6, and we just didn't go back there. So to go and be in Savannah and feel both the heat and the warmth of the people there and helped to give back some of him to me, to go to the ocean and realize, to have it sort of dawn on me that he'd grown up so close to the ocean and that everywhere he was always trying to put me in water, a swimming pool, a lake, drive to Galveston. It's like we lived in a landlocked state. working on the project gave pieces of him back to me.
Would you and you have your upcoming book, Flying Over Home. Is it a novel or is it going to be?
It's a memoir.
Memoir. Would you read a little bit for us?
I'd be happy to. I'll read a little from the opening. About a page and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter 1, The Day My Father Died, 1976. A few stray daffodils had already opened by the 1st of March, 1976, and there was a light green wash on some of the trees. Spring was breaking out in Durham, North Carolina, and had been for weeks. The 1st of March fell on a Tuesday that year, and I, a second-year graduate student at Duke Divinity School, was in the school's Women's Center where I worked as the director. My red-headed friend and fellow student, Margie, had just arrived to strategize before our afternoon appointment with the dean. We planned to explain to our serious, justice-minded leader why it was important to have more women on the Divinity School faculty. We had only one woman teaching at the time, though women made up a quarter of the student body. Margie and I were standing in the small basement office, which our female professor had relinquished for our use. Since it was near the mail room and the noisy hub of the student life, she was probably just as happy to let it go and move up to the third floor. Our office had one tall, thin window that looked out on the back entrance of the school, blank sides of a few buildings, and some tall trees in the distance. When the phone rang on the desk by the window, I picked up the heavy metal receiver. The voice on the other end said, "Jeanette, this is your mother." I was surprised. Though I spoke with her regularly, she never called me at school. "Well, hello," I replied, still too young to dread unexpected phone calls. She may have said something else first, but all I heard was, "Your father died a few days ago." Something exploded inside of me, as though an airplane door had opened at 30,000 feet, and all the air and everything that wasn't strapped down was being sucked out. I was weeping and trying to catch my breath. "Oh," said a calm voice on the other end of the phone. "I forgot this would upset you." With that, my best support, my mother, flew out the window of the plane along with pocketbooks, peanuts, and life preservers. Upset? Had my mother taken leave of her senses? I only had one father. Even if he had been a poor substitute for one in recent years, he was still the only one I had. Upset? I was the kid who couldn't bear to part with her baby dolls. I had already lost him once, Well, twice, maybe three times.
Jeanette Stokes reading from her forthcoming memoir, Flying Over Home. But did your feeling for your father fundamentally change after he died?
Yes. Well, no. I mean, I adored him. I think parents are...
But clearly your mother didn't think so. Clearly there was something about how you were talking about him publicly that gave people an idea.
Right. Well, she had done her own healing and moved past and didn't at that point harbor a lot of resentment. So this is a dozen years after they've been divorced. And my love for him never went away, but it was buried under resentment. And so the journey for me was to find this funny, warm, smart, generous, friendly man whom I had adored as a child. And along the way, to recover the stories of things like he raised a chimpanzee along with one of his children in his second family, and to reconnect with the children from his second family.
Is this possible for people who can't find this shoebox of letters or have these letters mailed to them and get the actual biographical details to fill in? How do you do that when you may never get to those details?
Slowly, patiently, with friends or professionals who will listen to what you do remember. Because for most of us, under grief and anger about things that happened to us that we didn't want to have happen, underneath is love and joy and life.
So what's the future for your center? Are you going on new projects in the works?
Well, I'm 61. Some of the people on our board are that age, but we have nearly half of our board are women 30 and under. So we will go on with their future. They will go on eventually. Young women who want to appreciate the gifts and graces of women, who want to acknowledge that among other women, who want to write about it and gather and share their experiences with each other.
Well, I'm happy to hear you say that. And so happy you're on the show. Jeanette, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jeanette Stokes, founder and executive director of the Resource Center for Women and Ministry in the South. For more information, you can go to rcwms.org. That's the State of Things for today. You know where to find us, stateofthings.org. Our show is directed by Alex Granados, produced by Isaac Davey Aronson, Sean Wen, and Nicole Campbell. Christina Blythe's the intern. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is our news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.